Ladies and gentlemen of the audience, fellow counsel, may it please the court. My name is Robert Lichty, number 14652. I represent Mr. Sackler in this case. I hope to save as much time as possible for my rebuttal, approximately 5 minutes. There's only two facts that the court needs to understand, and those two facts are Mr. Sackler was terminated and signed the release regarding his employment termination in June of 2009. And it wasn't until later, approximately January, although the precise date is not important, but in January, 6 months later, January of 2010, he discovered that he had been made a scapegoat, and that was the reason for his termination. At that point, he realized that he was terminated for a legally improper reason as opposed to what he simply thought was a politically bad decision. He should not have been terminated, but he could not sue upon what he knew back in June of 2009.
Mr. Lichty, can I ask you on this, did Mr. Sackle need to know the precise reason or just that the conduct was legally improper?
I'm not really sure. Under these facts, I don't think there's a distinction between those two. And the reason why I say it is this. The second part of Comcast's argument is that Mr. Sackle could not prove his termination was improper. Okay? And as the court is aware, it's a very narrow basis upon which he can show that his termination was improper. Because otherwise, any termination you could pretty much show was improper, because I don't think I should have been terminated. Well, the court's not going to get involved in all terminations. I mean, that's very clear. That would be bad public policy, because employers have to be able to terminate for their reasons. However, under the law, there's a very narrow exception, and that's improper with quotations around it, because that's a term of art. So under these facts, the only thing that would have supported a claim, that is the only improper conduct, would have been him being used as a scapegoat in order for Comcast to avoid liability in another case.
Let me push back a little bit on that if I can.
Sure.
And I think we're saying the same thing. He's got a tort. There's a tortious interference claim that requires improper conduct.
Yes.
And I think what you're telling me is that the only improper conduct here was this bad motive, correct?
Yes.
All right, so let me ask you, there are some other facts here that we didn't talk about. The record here, the summary judgment record, would support an argument that at least that your client knew or believed that Mr. Nestor lied in the performance review or provided inaccurate information, that Mr. Phillips lied about the Comcast lawyer saying this is the worst investigation I've ever seen. Your client knew or felt that the defendants were retaliating against him before this deposition happened, and that he felt he was wrongfully terminated. Why don't all those facts, you got defamation, you have retaliation, you have my employer lied in my performance review, why doesn't that establish improper conduct and a basis for bringing a tortious interference claim?
I ask you this question. Would that be subject to a motion to dismiss? I am going to sue because I got a bad review, and I think that my supervisor actually lied in this review. I'm still working, but based upon your question to me, you're going through the thought experiment of, is that the improper conduct that would support a claim? I submit that it would not.
Okay, well tell me why. I mean, we're on summary judgment here. That's the evidence in the record. And what the district court concluded was that that the claim accrued at the time that your client knew of this. The other fact that we have is when this deposition came out, which is what your client is relying on, your client said, I wasn't surprised. This is more of the same. So how does that suddenly become the most material fact in the case when your client wasn't surprised, he says it's more of the same, and you have all of this at least bad conduct that your client believed? Why shouldn't your client have brought the claim back then?
To use an analogy, something that we all can understand, when the Nixon tapes came out. I'm sure there were many people who said, you know, I'm not surprised. That's consistent with his character. But the fact that the tapes were erased, that is something of a different character. The same type of thing here. I'm not surprised. I'm dealing with people that I don't like, that I suspect are not, you know, honorable people. However, will that support a claim for relief? I submit no. The only thing in this case that would support the claim for relief was the improper motive, and I didn't quite tie that up, because it's tied up in this way. Mr. Sackle is claiming that he was the scapegoat in the termination of the other individual, and that for Comcast to clean their hands, let's get rid of Sackle because he's the bad guy who caused us to terminate this other person. That, precisely, that is the improper conduct. Until you can tie that up, he really doesn't have a claim, because it has to be connected to his termination.
Mr.
Lickety, let me step back for a minute and ask you about how we frame and define the precise legal issue that's before us here.
I'm glad you asked the question.
Let me ask the question. Your brief, one of the principal arguments is that the trial court strayed and analyzed the issue in an incorrect way by using the accrual analysis regarding statute of limitations. Now, explain to me why that was an incorrect legal analysis when the language out of the release document itself uses the word arises, and everybody, including you, seems to agree that means accrual.
Right.
So why is that the wrong legal analysis then?
Bottom line, this is a contract case.
It's not a contract case. Well, it's a tort case.
Well, no, I'm sorry. Bottom line, this is a contract analysis, because the judge said that under this contract, you release this claim.
Correct.
That's what he said. So, and I'm going to get to the answer to your question, but is the judge saying that Mr. Sackle should have sued back in June? Well, he didn't have a basis. So that would be bad public policy. Is the judge saying that even though this was undiscovered at the time you signed the release, you release it anyway? That is bad public policy also, because it doesn't follow the terms of the contract. Now, some contracts, some release contracts will say, I am releasing all claims both known and unknown. That would be a different issue, because now you're releasing an unknown claim. But in this case, the contract read, I am releasing all claims except for those which may arise after I sign this document.
Well, so the question is, to figure out when a claim arises,
right,
you look at the accrual standards, which talk about whether you knew or should have known of your injury and the cause of the injury.
Right.
Let me finish my question. Why isn't the injury being terminated and the cause of the injury being your client's boss's decision that you should be terminated, or recommendation? Why didn't he know those things back then? And if that's the case, why didn't the cause of action accrue back then?
He didn't know the reason for the termination. He knew that he was terminated. He thought it was a bad decision. He didn't know the actual reason for the termination. And look at it this way. Comcast's second argument is, Mr. Sackle doesn't have a claim because he really can't prove that he was fired because he was made a scapegoat. He can't prove that. Well, isn't that what we're talking about? We're not talking about Mr. Sackle can't prove that it was a bad decision to terminate him, because that's not a claim.
Mr. Lickety, would you agree that he had some obligation to investigate the circumstances of his termination on the date that he was terminated?
Why?
Because, I'm sorry, go ahead, Jess.
That's the date of the cause of the termination,
right,
the cause of the injury. So why at that point, given the facts in the summary judgment record, that he had some concerns, wasn't he under any obligation to do some investigation at that point in time?
And let me just add, because the standard is knew or should reasonably should have known.
Is that the public policy this court wants to promote?
That's the law.
No, but is that the public it's not in a case like this. When a person is terminated, think of all the terminations that occur this week. And think of all the people who are terminated who, you know, I disagree with this. So if they're under an obligation now to investigate and try to dig up whatever dirty laundry they can, what is the court going to do to help them in that regard? Because if they have a duty to do that, if they have a duty to investigate to find hidden motives, the court then, if you establish that duty, you have to give them some means to protect that. Is the court going to say, well, we're going to give these fired employees certain rights, where they get discovery, or they get some type of subpoena ability? They have to be able to investigate that. If you're going to put that duty on them, then give them some tools by which they can fulfill that duty. That's why I say why. Why would anybody investigate that? Now, you move on. He happened to discover this by accident.
Mr. Leake, you're leaving out facts, and this is and I have some issues with their argument too, but what concerns me most about yours is it's not just that, duty to investigate in the abstract. I don't think anybody's saying he had to go get discovery and all this. The issue is he knew certain facts.
Right.
He knew Mr. Nestor and Mr. Phillips lied to him, or he believed that. He actually asked in the termination meeting, did this have to do with my investigation? Doesn't that suggest to you that he reasonably should have known the investigation, his faulty investigation, had something to do with his firing? And that was an issue. It's not just investigation, they're facts.
He didn't realize it was completely hidden to him until he saw that deposition. It was completely hidden to him that he was connected to the Nestor termination. He said in his deposition, in this case, he said, I had no idea that he was terminated for months afterwards. So again, why? My question to you is, why would he even think that he should investigate that? It's over and done with.
But I
understand what you're saying, that he has a duty now to go out and see if he's got a cause of action. Well, let's see. If you've got a car accident, you know, that's a whole different set of circumstances. Because in a car accident, normally one person's to blame. It's not very often where it's blameless on both sides. It can happen. But in a termination, most of the time the employer has more or less free rein, unless there's some type of discrimination involved. But we don't have that in this case, nothing like that in this case.
Aren't you then reading out the should have known part of the discovery rule? It appears
No. The jury can decide that. But the should have known part goes to a jury. The judge doesn't decide that on summary judgment.
That's a different analysis. I mean, you started out by saying it's the wrong analysis even to use the discovery rule. Are now you saying it's okay to use that analysis if there are factual issues that should be decided by a jury?
Well, what I'm saying is that if this court reverses and we go to trial, Comcast should at least be given the opportunity to make that argument. But that's a factual dispute. And Mr. Sackle's going to say, why would I have looked at it? I discovered this by accident. And when I discovered it, that's when the claim arose, and it's only that claim that is not disposed of in my release. I would like to save what little bit of time I have left over. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lickley. You've got about 1 minute and 11 seconds for rebuttal.
May I proceed? Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Darren Magander, attorney registration number 23296. I'm counsel for the four remaining defendants in this case, Tim Nestor, Ron Phillips, Comcast Cable Communications LLC, and Comcast Cable Communications Holdings, Inc. In the view of the defendants, the only issue before the court today is whether Mike Sackel's claims for intentional interference with contract against Mr. Nestor and Mr. Phillips, and by extension his claims for vicarious liability against the Comcast entities, existed or had arisen at the time he signed a general release of claims on July 2, 2009. The district court concluded that those claims did exist at that time and consequently were waived, and we believe that was the right conclusion. It's not an exaggeration to say that the issue in this case, resolution of the issue in this case, really turns on two or three sentences uttered by Ron Phillips in a deposition in another case in December of 2009. It's undisputed that Mr. Sackel knew of every other fact on which he's basing his claims at the time he signed the release in July of 2009. Mr. Sackel argues that Mr. Phillips' testimony in that other case gave rise to claims that didn't exist before the deposition. It's the defendant's view that those claims existed in June of 2009 at the time that Mr. Sackel was terminated. At that time, Mr. Sackel knew that he had suffered an injury. He'd lost his at-will employment. And he knew the cause of that injury. He believed that Mr. Nestor and Mr. Phillips had conspired to retaliate against him and to fabricate false and defamatory reasons for his termination. About 10 months after his termination...
Did he know that, or is that something he should have known at that time?
At that time, we dispute, Your Honor, that the reasons for his termination were false or defamatory, but at that time, he knew those facts. He was given a performance review in March of 2009. He testified in his deposition that everything in that performance review, with the exception of a couple of statements, were false and defamatory. And he believed that Mr. Phillips and Mr. Nestor were working together to bring about his termination.
But there's a difference between defamation and intentional interference with contract. We're not looking at the defamation claim anymore. We're looking at intentional interference with contract. And so under the elements of that claim, did he know what his injury was, and did he know what the cause, or should he have known the cause of the injury? If he didn't know anything about the specific testimony that Mr. Phillips ultimately gave in his deposition at the time?
Well, he certainly knew that he'd been injured. He knew that he lost his job. And he knew the cause of that injury. He knew that Mr. Nestor made the decision to terminate his employment. And the facts that I was talking about go to whether that termination, Mr. Nestor's actions, were improper. The fact that he believed, Mr. Sackel believed, that the reasons for his termination were false and defamatory. I understand that he's dropped his defamation claims against Mr. Nestor and Mr. Phillips, but those facts also go to whether he should have known that the reason for his termination was improper.
Okay.
So it goes to the factors that would inform that element of the claim.
So I want to ask you some questions about the words of the release itself, because as I look at this case, that really governs what we're talking about here. Does the release bind him as to this case, as to this claim, based on the language in the release itself? So you have two things that are troubling me about that language. In the very last sentence, you have that word about arising afterwards. And that's what is the link to this discovery rule that we've been talking about, knew or should have known. But before you even get to that language, it talks about he knowingly and voluntarily waives and releases. Now, how do you make those two clauses or phrases consistent?
I'd like to take that in two parts, Your Honor. First, I'd like to briefly address an issue with respect to preservation of issues on appeal. Mr. Sackel never made an argument to the district court that this release was not knowing and voluntary, or that it didn't cover unknown claims. In other words, he never made an argument about the scope of the release, whether there were any limitations on the scope of the release. We argued that the defendants argued that the release was all-inclusive. It covered all defendants and all claims, known or unknown, and the district court agreed with that. We acknowledged that there was a carve-out for unaccrued claims, which goes to your question, Your Honor, and we addressed that issue on summary judgment. In response to the defendant's motion for summary judgment, Mr. Sackle only addressed that issue, whether his claim had accrued at the time that he executed the release. The district court agreed with us that the release was all-inclusive, and then also agreed with us that the claims had accrued at the time the release was executed. So I don't believe that Mr. Sackle preserved that issue. But going to the merits of that issue, going to the language of the release, it's hard to discern what it is that Mr. Sackle's arguing. It may be that he's arguing that he didn't knowingly and voluntarily sign the release, and it may be that he's arguing that the release is limited in scope to known claims. Neither argument has any merit. With respect to the first issue, Mr. Sackle was given 21 days to consider the release. He was given 7 days to revoke the lease after he signed it. He was explicitly encouraged to consult with counsel before signing the release. And in fact, he took that release, contacted a corporate HR representative at Comcast, and negotiated a significantly better deal for himself. The parties revised the severance agreement that he received at the time of his termination, and then he executed that on July 2, 2009. He never revoked that. He knew what he was signing. He knowingly and voluntarily signed that release. Now, with respect to the scope of the release, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has given effect to general releases of this nature. In Buttermore v. Aliquippa Hospital, the court set out some guidance for interpreting general releases of this nature. It said courts should give effect to the intentions of the party. Courts should look at the plain language of the agreement to see if it covers the claims. Further said that a release of this nature covers all potential tortfeasors, even if they're not named in the release. The court clearly said in that case that general releases can be enforced according to their clear and unambiguous language. In a later case, Republic Insurance v. Paul Davies Systems, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court enforced a general release that's remarkably similar to this release. And there was no language in that release that's referred to claims known or unknown. The court enforced that general release and it applied it to all claims known or unknown. In another case, this one from the Third Circuit, applying Pennsylvania law, this is Three Rivers Motors Company, 522 F. 2nd, 885. The Third Circuit was asked to interpret a general release of this nature. Again, that release didn't refer to claims known or unknown. The Third Circuit said, in interpreting that release, this language is as comprehensive as language can be. The general words, all in all manner of action and actions whatsoever in law, in admiralty, or in equity, which plaintiffs ever had, now have, or which they hereafter can, shall, or may have, indicates a clear intent to leave nothing open and unsettled between the parties. There is not the merest suggestion of a reservation of rights. The court went on in that case to say the language that referring to claims that a party ever had, now has, or which they may have, was the same as saying claims known or unknown.
Mr. McNerd, this isn't quite a general lease. You do have a carve-out here.
We do have a carve-out.
So it has to mean something. It has to have some meaning that you have it in there. So what about appellant's argument that he couldn't have known of the improper termination until after he signed the severance? Isn't that a factual issue for the jury?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. As the saying goes, the devil's in the details. And the testimony by Mr. Phillips that Mr. Sackle's relying on this case doesn't change the analysis with respect to the effect of the release. Mr. Phillips was testifying in another employment case in California. It was a former employee who had been terminated and brought a claim against Comcast. Mr. Sackle had been involved in the investigation leading up to that employee's termination, and that's how he was involved in that case. He ended up being a defendant in that case, and Comcast indemnified him, and he got out of the case without paying a penny. In that case, Mr. Phillips was asked how he learned that the plaintiff was to be terminated. He testified that he didn't know who made the decision to terminate the employee in this other case. And he further testified that he first learned from Mr. Sackle that the employee was to be terminated. Now, Mr. Sackle's argument in this case, as Mr. Lichty has said, is that until that moment, he didn't know the reason for his termination. Well, it's hard to figure how that testimony by Mr. Phillips reflects some scheme to make Mr. Sackle a scapegoat in this other case.
Let me ask you, Mr. McIntyre, with respect, I'm not sure that you're summarizing Mr. Lichty's argument properly. He says there's a factual question as to whether Mr. Sackle knew or should have known that he had a tortious interference claim before he learned about this deposition. Now, you've talked about some of the facts that I raised with Mr. Lichty, and I said to Mr. Lichty, I'm going to push back on you a little bit, so here it comes. You say that Mr. Sackle knew that there was defamation and he knew all these facts. I mean, it seems to me the record is he suspected that some of this went on. He thought, oh, that doesn't sound right to me. I think this is just, you know, corporate hoo-ha. I don't think they had any real basis. I don't like it. I think it's improper, but I don't think it's actionable. He thought they lied. He did know about, you know, the Comcast employee who I never said that it was the worst investigation, whatever. He had some suspicions, though. Why couldn't a reasonable jury say, well, I think he had suspicions, but that didn't give him a right to bring a tortious interference claim until he kind of heard this deposition and put two and two together that this was all a charade and they were trying to pin him with the fault for the termination to give themselves a defense. Why? I understand you strongly disagree with that, but why couldn't a reasonable jury reach that conclusion from that evidence?
I just don't think the evidence supports it, Your Honor, and I don't think that a jury could put two and two together and say that the reason for his termination was to make him a scapegoat in the other case based on Mr. Phillips' testimony.
Now you're on the second issue, the last issue in your brief, that he loses on the merits. But I'm just talking about the accrual. Why don't we have a fact question as to whether when the claim accrued?
Well, I think that takes us back to the Colorado statute for accrual with respect to these kinds of claims. So a cause of action for injury to a reputation accrues at the time the injury and its cause are known or should have been known by the exercise of reasonable diligence. He doesn't have to establish every fact going to his claim. He has to, if those two things are present, injury and cause, the cause of action accrues at that point. And in Sterenbuck v. Goss, this court said that the injury occurs when the interference succeeded. So I think the facts that Mr. Sackle knew at that time or should have known at that time were sufficient to give rise to his cause of action.
Tell me why. I mean, that's your conclusion.
It goes to, the facts that he knew go to his injury. He knew that he'd been injured. And he, in his own mind, again, this is where we get into dispute of facts, but this is based on his own testimony, his own evidence in the case. He believed that Mr. Sackle and Mr. Nestor both were involved in his termination, that they conspired to fabricate false and defamatory reasons for his termination. In Sterenbuck, for example, the plaintiff in that case argued that the defendant had used defamation to encourage the plaintiff's clients to breach their contingent fee agreements and sign with the defendant in that case. That was an alleged improper inducement for breach of a contract. He knew enough facts to state a claim for improper inducement.
Although Sterenbach really dealt with when the injury occurred, and I think this case deals with when the cause happened. The first piece, not the injury.
Yes, that's a fair analysis, Your Honor. Sterenbuck did really deal with when the injury occurred, and most cases do, because in most cases, the plaintiff knows that there's a third party messing around with the agreement, just like Mr. Sackle knew in this case, that there was a third party interfering with his at-will employment agreement. He knew that Mr. Nestor made the decision to terminate him. He believed that Mr. Phillips was involved in that decision. He believed that they were making false and defamatory statements about his performance to induce the breach of that agreement. I'd like to touch real briefly on Mr. Phillips' testimony. Improper motive is not an essential element of an intentional interference claim. It goes to whether interference is improper. But he doesn't have to show that to state a claim.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your time is up. Mr. Lichty, you've got 1 minute and 11 seconds.
Thank you very much. I think the court understands what the issues are, and I just want to remind the court about the Winkler case. The Winkler case, remember, that's the one where the parishioner was assaulted by the priest. Well, a year and a half earlier, she had been assaulted by the pastor. Doesn't that put her on notice? But this court said, no, not until the next person, not until she found out about the next person, was she on notice that there was a negligent hiring issue.
What in that case would have put her on notice that the church and the conference knew and didn't act? The fact that she was assaulted doesn't necessarily put her on notice that the conference or the church knew.
And the fact that she found out that a second person was assaulted, does that change things at all? Not really.
Well, the second person said it happened to you too.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is it's a factual question that is for the jury, and that's where Winkler has its biggest effect on this case. And I object to Mr. McIntyre saying that Mr. Sackle knew his claim back in June. He could not have brought a claim in June. We all agree with that. It was not until he saw the deposition testimony that he could have possibly have brought the claim. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your very helpful arguments. Opinion will issue in due course.